We spent last week on Maimonides, the Mishnah Torah, looking particularly at some of the organizational structure there. I will add that in an article by Chaim Soloveitchik, who's one scholar of Jewish law, particularly medieval Jewish texts, he talks about how a lot of the organizational structure of Maimonides can actually be explained by seeing it as in some sort of polemic conversation with the Karaites at the time, who we talked about, those Jews who did not accept Rabbinic Judaism, the emphasis on the verses from the Torah that we talked about, and some of the other motifs that emerge, including what we saw at the end of last week, the importance of enjoying Shabbat, Oneg Shabbat, as one of the core features, as opposed to Shabbat being a more minimalist and somewhat ascetic experience. So in any case, I wanted to start, we're moving on today beyond Maimonides. We're going to spend most of our time today on the Torah, the code by Rabbeinu Yaakov Bar Asher. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But I wanted to share with you something that I think is sometimes not paid enough attention to, which is, what is the verse that Maimonides uses to dedicate the Mishnah Torah? So if you think about dedications of books nowadays, people will often have some little pithy quote that they put in before the introduction. So what does Maimonides put in as the dedication for the Mishnah Torah? Does anybody happen to know? The introductory verse to the Mishnah Torah is from Psalms, Psalms 119. It's verse 7. Az lo evosh behabiti al kol mitzvotecha. Then I would not be ashamed when I regard all your commandments, when I gaze on all your commandments. That's how Maimonides introduces his code. And I think it has a couple of different meanings. I'm actually curious if anybody here has a thought on why this might be the introduction of the code. Then I won't be embarrassed when I gaze at all your commandments. Any thoughts on what it might mean to start a code of law with that sentiment?
It kind of taking like a critical kind of stance. It's less like commenting on what God is speaking in the verses. It kind of reminds me of like Maimonides in his like position of this like diverse religious like world, and his like drive towards like sort of metaphysics and like systematic philosophy, and like him using this project as an attempt to say like, look, we have this huge messy body of work, but it's all there, and it all can be codified and like made rational.
Okay, amazing. Yeah, I do think that that is one possible meaning of this. Right, Maimonides actually, in his milieu, right, we talked about how he's around these other Muslim philosophers who are engaging in projects of sort of organized law. Actually, Maimonides might have had some intuition of embarrassment when looking at the anarchic traditions of Jewish law, right? And part of the kind of rationalist project is to organize all of that and to present all of Jewish law in sort of both neat categories and giving rationales, whether that's rooted in biblical verses or being rooted in biblical verses alongside some of Maimonides' own reason, that actually this project is about actively creating a sort of system of halakha that he will no longer feel embarrassed about, to put it in maybe strong, that might be too strong terms, but sort of the philosopher who wrote The Guide to the Perplexed is maybe initially kind of perplexed about what to do with the anarchy and what can sometimes be perceived as irrational nature of Jewish law and ritual. So this project is to kind of combat that actively. There's, I would say, maybe a more, traditionalist probably isn't the word, but like pious reading of this, where if you look at it in the context of the verse in Psalms, right, that is, Achala yikonu derachai lishmor chukecha, would that my ways were firm in keeping your laws, then I would not be ashamed when I regard all your commandments. So there's another kind of pious reading of this, which is like, there's just so much to know. How can you possibly keep all the laws properly if you don't even know them that well? And so the idea here was to create an accessible and organized code so that people could have access to all of these laws and then be able to follow them properly. And I think that those two approaches are worth holding side by side, even though one might feel more pietistic and one might feel more critical. I think it's worth it to hold that side by side, because even the more critical project that Alex was alluding to like, to not want to feel embarrassed by what seems like irrational laws, is really geared towards somebody being able to be inside this full practice of Jewish law and feel sort of proud about that, as opposed to feeling embarrassed. Okay, but I wanted to share that because I think it's worth seeing that feeling of busha, of embarrassment, named so prominently. My father-in-law, who's a professor in Talmud at University of Toronto, edited a book called The Embarrassment of Scripture, about how a feeling of embarrassment towards our inherited canon can actually sometimes really catalyze the most generative reinterpretations. And so I think, as like a short little introduction to a massive project of engaging so deeply with halacha, it's kind of a beautiful sentiment to see that whether we might feel a sense of embarrassment by not knowing enough, or whether we might feel a sense of embarrassment of what we see when we come to know more, and are like, oh, that doesn't seem to fully represent what I care about, that hopefully that's all an invitation for greater engagement. Okay. We will move forward in our main topic for today, which is the Torah. And I will just pause for one more thing, which is to dedicate our learning to the memory of Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who passed away over the weekend. Clearly an inspiring teacher of Torah for many, and we can dedicate our learning to his memory today. Okay, I wanted to give you a little bit of an overview as we make our way to the tour. So just where are we in the history of halacha? So we've spent some time, after looking at the Talmud, we've looked a little bit at Geonim, that period between the Talmud and the medieval interpreters of the Talmud, who really are the first to kind of be putting out works that you might call halachic in genre. We talked about how for the Geonim, they didn't have any comprehensive codes. There were sometimes treatises on specific topics, like how to do shechita or contracts, since there was so much trade happening between Jews in those days. We looked at the Rif, Rav Yitzchak Alfasi, who was in North Africa, 11th century, and saw how he abridged the Talmud so that it would only have the parts that were legally relevant and weighed in with positions at certain points. And then we spent last week with Maimonides, Spain, North Africa, 12th century, as the first comprehensive organized code that encompassed all of Jewish law, things that applied to the times of the Beit HaMikdash, the Temple, and when there was Jewish sovereignty in Israel, and things that applied equally in exile. We didn't spend much time with other scholarly projects that are happening in Northern Europe. So we know Rashi, who's a commentator, right, is a gloss on the Talmud, is not trying to create an organized code of law in any way. And the Tosafists, who continue that trend, 12th to 13th century in Germany and France, of glossing the Talmud, including comments that are relevant for thinking about what the law should be, but not really creating an organized code in any way. So we're going to sort of shift over to Northern Europe for two more pieces of information before we jump to the Tor, the next kind of formative code of Jewish law. So we have Rav Moshe of Cousy in France, the Smag, who's one of the Tosafists, writes the Sefer Mitzvot Gadol, Book of Mitzvot, the big Book of Mitzvot, and then included all of the Mitzvot that were relevant in diaspora, organized by positive commandments and negative commandments, as opposed to being organized by topic, like Maimonides does. Interestingly, we have another organizing principle, which is a principle about the ten, the Aseret Hadibrot, the Ten Commandments become an organizing principle here as well. So that's a some Northern Europe kind of codification of Jewish law happening. And that's not used as much as some of the later codes because it's a little bit harder to interface with since it's not topically organized. And finally, the other sort of figure we need to mention is Rav Asher ben Yechiel, who's known as the Rosh. And it's this arrow here that's the most significant part of his biography. He's born in Cologne in Germany, so in this world of the Tosafists, but then the Jews are expelled from Germany. So gets kicked out, I think that's 1290, and travels to Toledo in Spain. And so just by virtue of his own personal story and biography represents a meeting point between what's happening in Northern Europe and what is happening in Spain. Does not write a code of Jewish law, is focused around commenting on passages in the Talmud, but it's his son, Rabbeinu Yaakov bar Asher, this Asher being the same as this Asher, who also made that journey with his father from Cologne to Toledo when he was younger. And Rabbeinu Yaakov bar Asher is the one to codify Jewish law into four main topics. This is the Arba Turim. Four main topics: Or HaChaim for daily prayer, Shabbat holidays, Yoredeya, broad range of ritual, Evan Ha'ezer on marriage, family, Choshen Mishpat, financial, legal procedure, damages, all things that were relevant in diaspora, not including anything of what is only relevant for the times of the temple. Okay, but what's significant about this is that the Torah becomes a kind of integrated approach that combines positions that are coming from Northern Europe, from Ashkenaz, including positions of the Tosafists, and positions that are and approaches that are emerging in Spain. And this is going to become the bedrock for the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law that we'll spend time with soon. Okay, so that's just a word of where are we and why is it so exciting to get to the Torah, because we have this moment of these two different spheres of approaching tradition coming together. What's going to emerge about some of the organizing principles of the Torah as we look at Hilchot Shabbat? So I brought you the first siman, it's called. It's organized by simanim rather than prakim, rather than chapters. The first section of laws of Shabbat in the Torah, which is an Orach Chaim, since it's something that has to do with sort of the rhythm of daily, weekly, and holiday life. So we're going to look at how this differs from Maimonides. Okay. Any brave soul want to read?
Okay. We write in chapter 22 of Tractate Shabbat, Rav Yochanan said, in the name of Rav Yosiah, anyone who delights in Shabbat is given an inheritance with no limits.
Okay, great. That should have been is given. I'm sorry. Beautiful. Okay. So just with that alone, right, what's the sort of tenor that the Torah is beginning with to lay out the laws of Shabbat? Is there any mention of melacha, of labor yet? Not yet. Right? Our key term is anyone who delights. This is going to be an oneg-centered approach to Shabbat. Okay, where did we see Oneg in Maimonides? Organizational structure-wise? At the end, David is saying, I can tell even though you're on mute. Yes. Okay, so this is kind of literally the opposite in terms of what's grounding us in our approach to Shabbat, what's going to be framing everything else that he has to say about Shabbat. It is rooted in Oneg. Thank you for reading, Eve. You can kind of skim over this on your own, but you can see the sort of these are all other examples of rabbis in the Talmud who say sort of beautiful things. We would call this an agadic frame. It's coming from more narrative comments in the Talmud. Giving your heart's desires if you keep Shabbat will be redeemed immediately. That is the framework that the Torah gives us. New reader, to pick up with, we write in tractate Psachim towards the bottom of the page here.
We write in tractate Psachim on 65b, Rabbah said, all agree that Shabbat requires for you. As it is written, you shall call Shabbat a delight.
Okay, so here, right, lachem is the phrase in the Hebrew. There has to be something about Shabbat that is for you, which here seems to mean for your own enjoyment, right, based on that verse in Isaiah and Yeshayahu, Yikarat ala Shabbat oneg. Okay, so all agree that Shabbat has to have some element of delight. Go on, Alex.
The explanation is as follows. Since in one verse it writes, a festival shall be for you, and in another place it writes, a festival for Adonai your God.
Okay, so that's not much of an explanation yet, but we're seeing when it comes to festivals, there's actually some kind of tension between whether the purpose of a holiday is supposed to be lachem, for our own enjoyment, or for God, right? We have verses that point in different directions. Okay, how does this all play out? Go on, Alex.
Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshoshua differ
about. Sorry, that's my typo. Yeah.
He's like, oh, never heard of him. Yehoshua differ about it. Rabbi Eliezer was of the opinion that either it should be entirely for you, meaning to eat and drink and rejoice, or it should be entirely for God, meaning to study and review Torah.
Okay, so Rabbi Eliezer has an either-or approach. Either you devote the whole day to your own oneg, or you devote the whole day to God by learning Torah.
Rabbi Yehoshua was of the opinion to split it, half for God and half for you. Like it says that regarding Shabbat, everyone agrees that it also must be for you.
Sorry. Okay, so great. So we see here that there's a debate about holidays, whether a holiday is meant to be entirely for our own enjoyment or entirely for God. But Rabbi Yehoshua thinks when it comes to holidays, you should actually split them, part for God and part for us. However, what the Torah is telling us that even though this disagreement exists regarding holidays, is it for us or is it for God? Everyone agrees that when it comes to Shabbat, there must be an element that is lachem, for our own enjoyment. Okay, so here we see also sort of more infrastructure buildup dealing with this debate that exists on holidays about how to balance. What should our experience of Shabbat be? Is it mostly sitting around the table enjoying tasty food? Or is it making the effort to go to shul to study? We see that there has to be some level of oneg on Shabbat. Okay, I hope that just this laying out of, oh, is it for God or is it for me, maybe resonates with some tensions that we might all feel in deciding what to do on Shabbat, whether to sleep late or go to shul.
If we go back up to the top, with the statement of Sia, of Hamenaged HaShabbat Nadnimo Nachala B'limitzarim.
Yeah.
That it sounds like even if it's for us, there's a reward.
Right.
Of a limitless inheritance. Can you comment on that?
Comment on the limitless inheritance? Well, it's interesting, right? You might think Hamenaged HaShabbat, enjoying Shabbat, is maybe a reward in and of itself. But this is saying that there would be an even greater nachala beyond that. Yeah, there's a lot of other intertexts on this idea of nachala b'lo mitzarim. There's some comparison between Abraham and Yaakov and who inherits, who's sort of given the bigger promise of land when God offers them the promise about what their descendants will inherit. So it's actually greater for Yaakov. For Abraham, it's somewhat limited to where he steps. So that's part of the source for this. And the Midrash connects that with Yaakov keeping Shabbat in some way. But yeah, I think what I find kind of fascinating, and this actually plays into what we're going to see next, is what you might have thought that the language would be, if you make a sacrifice, not to work on Shabbat. If you make a sacrifice on Shabbat, that's what leads to a sort of totally expansive inheritance for thinking about Olam Haba, whatever it might be that's inheritance, that's the inheritance. But here, what I think is somewhat maybe surprising is that actually the great reward is for enjoying Shabbat. It's for Oneg. I don't know if that touches on your question at all. What happens to the way we approach Shabbat when it's framed in terms of Oneg, in terms of delight? So on the one hand, it's like, okay, maybe that sort of focuses Shabbat in a way that's easier, that's more comfortable than focusing on Shabbat in terms of refraining from all manner of work. But as we go on, we're going to see that it actually contains within it its own challenges and difficulties to frame Shabbat in terms of oneg, delight. He now is bringing a statement from Rabbi Akiva. Regarding what Rabbi Akiva said in Tractate Shabbat 118b, make your Shabbat into a weekday, asei Shabbatcha chol, and do not depend on others. That is when it is not possible. So he's bringing in this comment. It's a very fascinating comment from Rabbi Akiva in the Talmud. Rabbi Akiva says, make your Shabbat into a weekday, treat it like a weekday, to avoid being dependent on others. That statement appears in the Talmud. Out of context, you could imagine it going in a lot of directions. Right? Does Rabbi Akiva mean like, well, you might have to actually work on Shabbat so that you can make a living, not be dependent on others? Certainly some people who have ancestry in the United States and Jews who were immigrants who traveled here definitely made that decision at certain times. That seems like a difficult interpretation of this comment, because we know, we just saw it in Maimonides, that the death penalty for Shabbat makes these laws very severe. Would be surprising for Rabbi Akiva to say you can just ignore that, make your Shabbat into a weekday, for the sake of making money. But the way that the Torah is understanding this here is make your Shabbat into a weekday, meaning don't have any extra expenses on Shabbat, right? Don't buy better food on Shabbat. Don't make it a delight, an oneg, if that's going to force you to be dependent on others, if you cannot afford to make Shabbat special in that way, right? If that's just going to be prohibitive in cost, then your Shabbat is going to be, it's going to need to be like a weekday. So the Torah here is telling us that is when it is not possible. The only time that you don't have to engage in Oneg Shabbat and making Shabbat special is if it's really financially impossible. But when it is possible, one needs to honor it according to their abilities, as we write in Shabbat, rich people in all of the laws, in all of the lands, how do they merit? By showing honor to Shabbat. Right? So he's saying, right, in general, so long as one can honor Shabbat, one should do so to the extent of their abilities. Okay, we're going to get back to this piece from Rabbi Akiva. That's going to take up much of our attention in a minute. But just to give you some examples of, well, what does this look like, honoring Shabbat based on your own abilities? We have in the Talmud, right? This hasn't surfaced very much yet because we've been spending so much time on defining labor or, right, having the world be at rest. The Torah here is bringing the piece of the Talmud that asks, how do we make Shabbat delightful? That's the core question that the Torah here is bringing. And brings a lot of answers. Just wanted to find this in Hebrew. Bameh me'ango. How do we make Shabbat delightful? Oneg Shabbat isn't just given as something that we have to do, but there's actually examples, specific examples. And I just like reading this because you get a little of the social food history of the Talmud with big fish, heads of garlic, stews of spinach. And Rabbi Chia Bar Ashi here says, in the name of Rav, even a small thing that one did in order to honor Shabbat, that can also be considered delight, right? So it's not like you have to buy the most expensive things, just something that's a little bit different, smaller. And Rav Papa, who said, even fish hash, karsa de harsana, which seems like, I don't know, you might think of gefilte fish. It's not a particularly expensive food. This says the Torah is for one whom the time is pressing. The Misha Hashahat Dechukalo, you can make the sort of inexpensive fish hash, but the idea is it's some kind of food that differs from your usual. Okay, some of this might seem sort of small, whatever, but it's fascinating to me that this level of detail around Oneg and what Oneg looks like in real life with real people who have different means, who maybe have different food preferences, but that's actually what the Torah decides to put front and center in how we think about Shabbat. But we're going to see how this plays out now. And I love this next paragraph because it gives you a sense of the person behind the work. We're looking at these different genres of halachic compositions. Here's the person behind the work. We're going to find out a little bit more about Rabbeinu Yaakov Bar Asher and his own struggles. He says, I discussed the matter with my revered father multiple times. V'chama pa'amim nasati v'natati b'davar lifnei Adoni Avi. Remember, his father is Rabbeinu Asher, the Rosh, this sort of core scholar in the history of Halacha. He said, like the case of myself today, says Rabbeinu Yaakov Bar Asher, the case of myself today, I have only a little. I don't have a lot of means. It is not enough for me, and I am dependent on others. Whether I should observe the adage, make your Shabbat into a weekday or not. And he did not offer me a clear answer. So this is our, in the Hebrew, Yeshli ma'at mishali, inu maspikli, v'tzarich ani l'acharim. Right? What happens if I already am dependent on others? Can I become more dependent on others? Right? Require, take more from communal funds in order to make my Shabbat special. And I just, in order to fulfill Oneg Shabbat, or does Oneg Shabbat not apply if you can't afford it? Is it essentially a kind of class-based aspect of halacha? You only get to indulge in Oneg Shabbat if it is affordable for you. Now, I think this is totally fascinating. We'll see what happens as this goes on. Totally fascinating. That the Torah, on the one hand, puts Oneg Shabbat front and center, thinks you cannot learn anything about the laws of Shabbat unless it's coming from the centrality of Oneg Shabbat, and also tells us that he himself, it's not clear whether he can access that element of Shabbat at all. Right? He's saying, maybe I'm exempt from that. Maybe that doesn't apply to me because I cannot afford it. Right? What does it mean for him to be so aware of perhaps not being able to experience this element of Shabbat that he thinks is so foundational?
I guess my question is, how does this all jive with the Torah, what, you know, we are learning and all these other charities are saying and other people are doing? It's like, give money so people can enjoy a chag. Give money so people can buy the food for the chag. When the Torah says they shouldn't feel obligated, that they shouldn't, in fact, they shouldn't do that. They shouldn't rely on other people.
Right. So I have sort of two responses to the question. And just to be clear, we're sort of in the middle of this in the Torah itself. One is the question of, well, who is halacha talking to? Who do we think of halacha talking to? Who's sort of the main subject or audience? So this passage is directed to that person themselves who finds themselves in a financially difficult situation and is saying to them, possibly it's appropriate for your for the way you approach Shabbat to be shifted so you can manage. But that might be different than the message going to the larger community about what community funds should be designated for others, right? So you can actually imagine these two messages coexisting, depending on whom that piece of the halakha is talking to, which I also think is important when we think about halakha and the sort of dynamic nature of halakha and how you have a sort of system that can speak to different individuals. Well, this is one moment where there's sort of a sensitivity around class and means, the message you might hear from the kind of person who is struggling financially is one thing, while the message to the larger community might be different. There are other, this is a massive topic, and there are other, anytime we're sort of looking at a code, there's like, you know, 10 different sources that are behind this, or really more. The way that the Tosafists deal with this is to say, well, actually it makes a difference. You wouldn't want Shabbat to be the thing that sort of puts you over the edge and suddenly requires you to rely on others. But actually the Tosafist response to this in certain places is, if you already are relying on others, then certainly they should also be providing for Shabbat.
I had a comment about you, the way you presented it, Aviva, was of the Torah maybe not being able to personally access this thing that he thought was so important. And my initial read was actually the opposite of that, that because there were times in his life where he couldn't necessarily access it, it became very important to him, and that experience of like deprivation kind of highlighted to him the importance of this, and maybe led him to position it very prominently.
Okay, great, amazing. Yes, right. It could be that actually those areas of halakha that they struggle with more become right, actually have more significance and are more formative in one's approach. Okay. Yeah, I don't know on a historical level whether the Tor was in a much more difficult position than his father. I am not sure. I'm not sure what that is, what's happening there historically. Okay, but yes, but otherwise we're seeing like maybe this is about the number of meals. Indeed, if you look at this in the tractate Shabbat, it does seem to be about, do you have to have an extra meal on Shabbat or not? That is one of the main loci for this, as opposed to having a lot of fancy food. Okay, but in any case, the idea is that the centrality of Oneg Shabbat could be financially difficult. Okay, so here's what the Tor finds in response to his own question that his father doesn't really help him out with. Afterwards, I found in Rashi's commentary in Pirkei Avot, he explained the Mishnah in Avot, Rabbi Huda ben Tema would say, Ve'az kanamer, be strong like a leopard, la'asot ritzon avicha shabashamayim, to do your father's will in heaven. He wrote, in direct relationship to this Mishnah, Rabbi Akiva says, make your Shabbat into a weekday. Ben Tema's statement is taught to teach, Rabbi Akiva only said what he said to someone who is particularly pressing for them, but a person must spur themselves on like a leopard and an eagle to honor Sabbaths greatly. Sorry if my translation isn't the best here. Lizarez atzmo lechabed bioter. Whoops, sorry. That what he is taking from this is, to the extent that you can, you have to really push yourself and even sacrifice in order to experience Oneg Shabbat. And Rabbi Akiva really only applies to the most difficult of circumstances. What does that mean? Therefore, a person must contract in other days of the week in order to honor Shabbat and not say, how can I lose my livelihood? Or just the opposite. If one increases spending, they increase for them. Right? Brings in this idea from the Talmud where God says, you can borrow against me for Shabbat, I will pay back. You have a sort of mixed message here of wise financial planning, spending less in the other days of the week in order to honor Shabbat, alongside actually doing what seems like the Torah is suggesting might feel like going beyond your comfortable means in order to honor Shabbat. And I think it's sort of complex, right? On the one hand, we know that there are people who fasted. It seems like possibly the Torah was one of them, who had to fast during the week or not have as many meals so that they could honor Shabbat. And that I assume there might be mixed reactions to that kind of messaging. It seems like a large sacrifice. I do think it frames some of those opening comments about the great reward, right? Nachala b'limutzarim, the great reward that comes from delighting in Shabbat, which again maybe sounded counterintuitive initially. We now see that it could actually be a sacrifice to honor Shabbat and to have Oneg Shabbat. And on the one hand, you sort of have these messages of, okay, there is an out. You have Rabbi Akiva as an out, if this is really completely unaffordable. But also what I think you have here, like we saw at the end of Maimonides, that kind of not moving stuff around as a more egalitarian approach to Shabbat. Everybody should have some experience of rest, no matter what their work is. Right here we see that there is this desire for everybody to have this experience of Oneg Shabbat, even when that might be a big sacrifice. Yes, Carol.
I read recently in something I was studying that, you know, the whole idea of the extra meal on Shabbat, like, wouldn't it make more sense? I think this was from the Talmud, to have more food during the week when you're working and need more energy. Or do you need that extra meal on Shabbat when you're less active? But then the point was made of maybe, you know, you spoke about fasting during the week, but sometimes if you fast on a special day like Yom Kippur or Shabbat, you're more alert and more in tune with the sacredness of the day. What do you think about that, Rabbi? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So we saw alluded to in our sort of earliest encounters, I mentioned this, that there were some sects, it seems, in the Second Temple who actually who fasted on Shabbat as a sign of the holiness of the day. So Shabbat ends up emerging as kind of a parallel to Yom Kippur. This is definitely magnified in Hasidic writings too. But that the rabbinic approach to Shabbat, and definitely what the Torah here is pushing, is that Oneg and Kiddusha, right, that the sacredness of Shabbat can really sit alongside an experience of delight. That's not the only way to experience, you know, Kiddusha, and you certainly have Yom Kippur as an alternate model. But this is like the dominant regular rhythm model every week. That is more of this integration between our bodily delight, our bodily rest and restoration, alongside Kiddusha and sacredness. But yes, I hear the point. So I think I'll give you this last piece here, which is just a kind of a measure of I hope this sort of is a measure of like the complexity and some of the sensitivity around how halacha and Jewish law is situated in a whole range of factors and experiences, including economically diverse experiences. He closes by bringing the sort of famous story of Beit Shammai, of Shammai and Hillel, and how they honored Shabbat, where Shammai throughout the week would make sure to find something, right? Already on Sunday, he'd find a nice animal, decide this is for Shabbat. Next day he'd find one that was better, so he'd end up having to eat the first one, and it ended up actually having a great week. Clearly he could afford this, and in planning for Shabbat. But on the other hand, Hillel, who we know was more poor, was just focused on day by day, right? Didn't have this approach of getting things for Shabbat from the beginning of the week. But I want to sort of close this opening of the Torah by saying this last story, besides demonstrating how there might be these two different approaches to be focused on honoring Shabbat, right? Also, what this story does effectively organizationally is bring the idea of Oneg Shabbat and honoring Shabbat already into Sunday. Right? If we are oriented towards how am I going to be ready for Shabbat, and you have the Shammai model, which is buying a nice animal. You have what the Torah is suggesting that others might be needing to do, which is contracting in other days of the week, whether we think that is, you know, the wisest course or not, based on Carol's comment here. But either way, you sort of end with this picture of the whole week is oriented towards creating a Shabbat that can be a Shabbat of Kavod and Oneg, where there's delight and honoring Shabbat. And that, I think, is actually kind of brilliant on the part of the Torah, because then the continuation gets into what we saw a little bit in the Mishnah, which is an organizational structure that starts with things that have to do with the way that Shabbat law affects the days before Shabbat, right? What work can you do before Shabbat, leading into Shabbat? He starts with work that you might do with Gentiles, that, right, it could be that even before Shabbat, you have to think about what you can do in relation to Shabbat. But essentially, this opening frame, besides being, I think, lovely in emphasizing Oneg Shabbat, puts the centrality of Shabbat, right? How are we in a mindset of Shabbat each day of the week, even starting on the first day of the week? So we'll close with this. We'll close with this piece here. I hope you get a sense of how different this orientation is from Maimonides, right? Often in the Torah, an introduction to an area of law is centered in something that is a little bit more about kind of personal pious practice and almost ethos, as opposed to the kind of organizational structure of Maimonides that's going to be about tying things to their source in biblical law and their rational explanations. So good to be with all of you. Take care, and I feel like I can say Shabbat Shalom, even though it's only Tuesday.